From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Right now, we're bracing ourselves for another exit poll debacle. It's been a terrible decade for exit pollsters. In 2000, shame rained down on the now-defunct Voter News Service when it called Florida for Gore. In 2004, leaked poll data showed Kerry surging until he lost. This year, the exit poll data will come from the National Election Pool, a consortium of the five major networks and the Associated Press, each of which will have people sequestered with the incoming information. Joe Lenski is one of the founders of Edison Media Research, which, along with Matofsky Research, will conduct the polls. Lenski says they figured out how to cure the two biggest problems plaguing exit polls. One, the overcounting of Democratic voters, because young Democrats are more responsive to the usually young exit pollsters, and two, all those awful leaks.
The first thing we did, starting in 2006, the news organizations established what they call a quarantine room. And that means there are three representatives from each of the six news organizations in that room, and they are the only people allowed to review the exit poll data before 5 p.m. Those people give up any ability to communicate to the outside world, so their cell phones, their BlackBerries, any other communication devices are confiscated, and their jobs are to review the data before it's released to the rest of the news organization at 5 p.m. That has helped both in 2006 and the 2008 primaries to keep a handle on the distribution of the exit poll data until much closer to poll closing time.
And the overrepresentation of Democrats problem?
We've done several things here, mainly in the hiring and training practices of the more than 1,000 interviewers that we have around the country in all 50 states on Election Day. We found that older voters were much less likely to fill out a questionnaire that was handed to them by younger interviewers. So we have increased the average age of our interviewers, and we find that we get a higher response rate from older voters when the interviewer is older as well. And our interviewers are better trained to select voters as they leave the polling place in a random way so that that sample best reflects the voters at that polling place. But we always have to keep in mind this is a survey like any other survey, and about 50% of the people that we approach still refuse to fill out the survey.
I want to ask you about the Bradley effect. If it is true that prospective voters misrepresent their intentions to pollsters before they vote because they don't want to portray themselves as racists, is there any reason to think that the Bradley effect wouldn't apply for exit polling as well?
It shouldn't apply, mainly because these are self-administered questionnaires. Our interviewer basically hands the questionnaire to the respondent, and the respondent confidentially marks their responses, folds the questionnaire, and puts it in a ballot box outside the polling place. We have never found any evidence that voters who fill out our surveys are lying to us about any of their answers.
This time around, there are a number of factors that could frustrate you. In some states, as many as a third of the votes will be cast before Election Day.
Let me correct that. One-third number you quote is probably a national number. There are many states where the percentage of voters voting early is well over 50% now. What we do in those cases is we do telephone surveys of early voters, and we merge that data with our exit polls on Election Day. So that's how we deal with the early voters.
Wow, never mind 5 p.m. on Election Day. Do you have enough data to project right this minute?
No. That data isn't even put in our system until Election Day. It has the same quarantine practices as the exit poll data.
So if 2000 was the ultimate nightmare for people like you, actually giving the nod to the wrong candidate, what is your nightmare? What can happen to just ruin your Election Day?
Basically not having a clear decision. There are many states where people fill out provisional ballots and those ballots aren't counted on election night. There are many states that don't even count the mail-in ballots until days after the election. If we have an election that's really close in key states, we just may be sitting there without a clear-cut result for several days.
So you don't professionally care who wins, but you're hoping for a landslide.
That does make our job a little easier, yes.
All right, Joe. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Joe Lenski is the co-founder and executive vice president of Edison Media Research.
Lenski and his pollsters may be hoping for a landslide, but for broadcasters who go live early evening on Election Day, a landslide would be nothing but trouble. How do you fill all those hours? As you heard, this year the members of the national election pool are quarantined with the incoming exit poll data until 5 p.m. Then they'll leave with some demographic data about who voted for whom and why, and with a few incomplete numbers which they're not supposed to report. They won't have the poll results from the West, which could be crucial. But with hours to fill, commentators may find themselves hinting and grasping at numerical scraps. Politico.com senior political writer David Kuhn says the current system, though improved, is still a recipe for disaster. The people with the data may not say those early numbers on TV, but...
After 5 o'clock, I fully expect them to leak. I think we're going to see these exit poll numbers online, and that's the problem. The news organizations may sponsor the exit polling, but after 5 o'clock, when the exit poll is given to the wider staffs of the news organizations, it's emailed to some blogger, somebody leaks it. That will then be linked to by Drudge Report, and they will be reporting that somebody is this much ahead on imperfect numbers. And so I think the news organizations bear as much responsibility, and I mean the executives, for the leaks as the person who leaks it.
In other words, you're advocating that they stay a couple of hours longer in the quarantine room.
I'm advocating that they stay a couple hours longer in the quarantine room, although it may starve pundits of a little bit of information for a couple hours. It will help enhance and secure the reputation of the news organizations.
What keeps the broadcasters from just holding out for concrete information?
Because they have competing pressures. One pressure is accuracy and their reputation, which was sullied terribly in 2000, most especially in Florida. But the other competing pressure is keeping viewers and offering a narrative arc that's extended long enough that, you know, lasts from 5 o'clock to 11, if not all night, rather than an hour period when, okay, here are the results, this is who won, and now let's go live to John McCain and Barack Obama accepting the presidency.
I understand that there's a new Pew Research poll that is gauging the public's opinion of the coverage of this election season, and a vast majority of them have come to the conclusion that the press is biased against McCain, right?
Not only that, 70% feel the press wants Barack Obama to win the presidency, and only 9% feels that the press wants John McCain to win the presidency. So that's a stark ratio, 7-1. 7-1 Americans is far bigger than any conservative media influence. This is simply larger than any swath of, let's say, who's watching Fox or listening to Rush.
But regardless of that lean, you don't anticipate that any legitimate media outlet is going to rush to judgment on election night.
I anticipate, to be honest, that one of the cable news networks who have the early exit polling will in very subtle ways say certain things because they see premature numbers, and it could lead to, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, the misperception that someone is far more ahead than they are. And so the best thing people can do is really turn off their televisions and their Blackberries and their radios for a couple hours and just wait till the numbers are coming in, the better exit poll numbers, and most importantly, the actual votes.
David Kuhn, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your taking this principled stance. I'm really looking forward to the mail. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David Kuhn is a senior political writer for Politico.com. Jeff Greenfield is a senior political correspondent for CBS News. He knows firsthand the havoc flawed poll data can cause. He wrote a book reflecting his own embarrassment called A Waiter, One Order of Crow. And he says the 5 p.m. quarantine imposed in 2006 was made to order.
The 5 o'clock quarantine was a great thing because what was happening was that first wave, highly misleading numbers were leaking out all over the place. And since these polls are the kind of the crack cocaine of political journalists, people were going nuts. And at least at 5 o'clock, you've got enough information
to begin to shape a story with a lot more reliability than with these completely inadequate numbers at 1 o'clock.
But can you explain to me what is this carefully choreographed ballet that on-air people like yourself have to do to tease out the information you think is reliable, keep the viewers with you, while all sorts of other information is just flooding out onto the internet and everybody is going to have their laptop open even as they watch you?
Well, there's no question that the explosion through the internet has changed the game. And what it actually has done is to make it more transparent. What used to happen is that everybody in the political world, particularly if it was a blowout, knew the results, but the public did. And now websites like Drudge and everybody else were posting the first wave information. But the other part is this is not a process on election night of simply reporting numbers. It is true that there are some elections where 1996, the most recent example, where you could have gone away in March, come back on election night and not missed a thing. It was a flatline election. But let's say that it becomes a blowout. Now, of course, casual political people who simply want to know who won will be able to know who won, you know, by 8 o'clock at night. Obama would be winning states like Virginia and Indiana or North Carolina. But for people who are interested in this process beyond that, there's a whole lot to talk about. How did people decide that they were comfortable with the idea of Barack Obama as president?
But hasn't that been the story since the primaries? I mean, not the exact same story, but pretty much the drift.
Well,
don't you worry that you may end up with not much to say on that big night?
Oh, Brooke, I think the election of the first African-American president probably will not leave too many of us without anything to say. In addition to which, whatever happens, in my view at least, makes for a really interesting story if you think about politics as more than just the horse race.
And so I can take away from this that when you're sitting there in front of the cameras on CBS and NBC and ABC have called Florida and Ohio and CBS hasn't, you're not going to break a sweat.
You know, I think we're not at a time anymore when if NBC beat CBS in Florida by 12 minutes, this doesn't strike me as a particularly crucial part of news coverage. The old rules of, oh boy, we called Nevada 7 minutes before the other guys.
Remember when that used to matter?
Yes, exactly so. It was a kind of a who's is bigger thing, if you'll pardon the inelegant way to put it. And frankly, there's just better things to talk about on election night.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Okay.
Jeff Greenfield is senior political correspondent for CBS News.
Up next, the Bradley effect that didn't even affect Bradley.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you know anything about the current presidential campaign, then you know something about the Bradley effect.
But until I get definitive proof that there's no such thing as a Bradley effect, I'll believe that it's there.
But I don't think there's any unique Bradley effect.
What that means is white voters are essentially lying to pollsters, saying they're going to vote for Barack Obama and then refusing to do that.
People say there's not a Bradley effect when we hear...
There could be a Bradley effect.
The term refers to the 1982 California gubernatorial race between Republican Attorney General George Duke Majan and Democrat Tom Bradley, five-term Los Angeles mayor and an African American. Even though polls had favored him to win, Bradley lost, supposedly because of hidden racism. This year, pundits are obsessed with the Bradley effect, whether there's a reverse Bradley effect or even a Bradley effect, whereby voters might be influenced by all the blather over the Bradley effect. Blair Levin worked for Bradley in the 1982 campaign, and he says we're reading the wrong draft of history.
I'm not a pollster, I'm not a statistician, but I was a witness to history, and to hear the history kind of inaccurately reflected caused me sometimes to laugh and sometimes to get a little upset.
I was the chief pollster in that election and part of the strategy team.
Lance Torrance was working for Bradley's opponent, Duke Majan, but like Blair, he's had enough of all the references to the effect.
In fact, I took it personally because so many people were quoting what happened in 82 that probably weren't even alive then, number one, and number two, had their facts messed up. And what really determined that it was a close election was the tracking. That was where we did interviews every single night. And from that, we knew we were doing better and better. We started out double-digit behind in early October, and by mid-October, it climbed within 7 points or so. By the end of the election, we knew it was within 1% either way. The Republicans did an absentee vote program stronger than the Democrats. The Democrats probably took that election a little bit for granted.
That day, we all had the emotion we thought we were going to win, but we also knew there was a significant risk we wouldn't. It was going to be a close election.
Bradley campaign staffer Blair Levin.
The night of the election, when the exit polls had declared Bradley the victor, there were 3,000 people celebrating downstairs at the hotel where we were having the party. And I was upstairs looking at the early polling results and realizing that first there were a huge number of absentee ballots that were not in our calculations and that they must have come from the Republican side. And then second, that there were the turnout in Central Valley was significantly greater than we had anticipated. And that had to do with the fact that there was this gun control initiative, which we knew would be a problem, but we had not anticipated the extent to which people in the Central Valley would show up, and they were largely Republican voters as well.
That blew a hole in the Democrats' arithmetic.
And they lost by a small margin, but they still lost.
I think it was less than 100,000 votes.
But Levin says hidden racism did not cause Bradley's defeat.
Well, to be clear, race definitely played a role in the election in a way that I suspect we'll never know. But what I feel very confident of is that those who say that there's this Bradley effect in which people lie to pollsters, that was not the cause. Bradley actually won Election Day. That is to say, if you take out the absentee ballots, he would have won.
Lance Torrance.
Now, the suggestion that race was a factor, and this is very important, really came from the preeminent public pollster in the state, Mervyn Field, who ran the California poll. And he proclaimed rather loudly right before the election that Bradley would win handily, in fact, by 7 or 8 points. The press accepted this as probably going to make history. It was Murfield, after the election was over, after the embarrassing results, who said, race must have been a factor. That's the only reason I can think of why our data was so off. But he never once really proved his case. And so from his comments after the election, the Bradley effect was born.
And Torrance, still a Republican strategist, says it persists because it's politically marketable.
This is purely a suggestion on my part of how it would be used in a marketing sense. You would tell particularly the black community that there is a lot of hidden racism that's going to somehow turn the election around and that you need to make sure you vote. Why else would a theory as porous, that is, not solid, be carried forward so long in American politics unless people wanted to keep race front and center? And it's quite historical to have a black man running for president of the United States, and a lot of people want that to happen. And indeed, Obama's favored to win this election. So it becomes one of these shadowy mysteries that maybe he might be denied this election at the last moment by invoking this Bradley effect. And I think that is a disservice to the American voting public.
The thing that struck me personally most,
Blair Levin,
Tom Bradley was really a wonderful person and really practiced the politics of inclusion. He presided for 20 years over an incredibly multicultural city. He helped bring the city together in many, many ways. And the notion that Tom Bradley is now remembered to a generation as part of this incident in which race played a very significant role, or at least that's the urban legend, saddened me tremendously. I mean, Tom Bradley ought to be remembered for something else, how he governed.
The Bradley effect had more or less dropped out of the political lexicon when it was revived with a vengeance after the New Hampshire primary, famously lost by Barack Obama after leading in the polls. In fact, between 1982 and that January primary in 2008, we found just 87 mentions of the Bradley effect in a Nexus search. Since then, it's been mentioned close to 1,000 times. But polling wunderkind Nate Silver, who blogs at 538.com, says there was no Bradley effect in New Hampshire. He says Obama's numbers were up after a decisive victory in the Iowa caucus, but a lot happened in the days leading to New Hampshire that the polls didn't have time to reflect.
In that interval between, I think it was a Thursday when Obama won the Iowa caucus and the Tuesday when New Hampshire voted, you had a debate. Hillary had a very dramatic kind of teary moment at a press conference. And you also had a Republican race. And in New Hampshire, they have an open primary. Literally, you kind of go in and decide, do I want a red ballot or a blue ballot, you know, Democrat or Republican. About half of the voters are independents. So I think a lot of independents who like both Obama and McCain might have looked at those polls and said, Obama's 8 points, 9 points ahead. McCain's in a very tight race with Mitt Romney, I'm going to have more leverage if I vote for McCain because I want to see those two candidates nominated.
So you refer to a study by a professor at Harvard as the definitive study on the Bradley effect. What did it find?
Yeah, it was a professor, I think, named Daniel Hopkins, who's a postdoc at Harvard. And he went back and looked at the polling in, you know, all sorts of races, gubernatorial races, Senate races, as well as this year's primaries, going back to 1980. When he found there did used to be a Bradley effect, which was pretty noticeable, maybe a 5 or 6 point margin where a black candidate would underperform his polls. In Chicago, Harold Washington won his mayoral race but was supposed to win by a larger margin. You know, David Dinkins in New York, you know, Wilder in Virginia, it's sometimes called the Wilder effect as well. So there were enough cases in that window from about 1982 to 1991. But sometime in the 90s, you stop seeing this where the polls are accurate. You know, for example, for Harold Ford in the Senate race in Tennessee, he lost, but he didn't lose by any more than was expected. So why it disappeared is the interesting question to me. The Harvard study speculates maybe it was the fact that issues like crime and welfare and affirmative action, which were, you know, really hot-button issues during the 80s, are not really the kind of at the forefront of the discussion today. I also think the fact that the electorate has changed, where racism is inversely correlated with education levels. Right now, I think something like 75 to 80% of the electorate has been to at least some college where you'll integrate with students of different backgrounds, whereas in 1988, 84, that number was more like 60%. It's generational as well. I mean, but it's partly just these things turning over slowly at a time, but there's no evidence that the Bradley effects existed for the past 10 years or so. We're kind of relying on quarter-century-old examples to kind of prop this idea up.
So it's a combination of essentially two things. Our society has changed, and polling methods have also changed, right?
I think so. I mean, you know, I also think people's attitude toward polls may have changed. If a pollster calls, you see them as a stranger, whereas before, you might see them almost as a neighbor or a friend, and then you might gravitate toward socially desirable behavior. That's where the whole notion comes from, the idea that people want to conceal their racism, I suppose. But if you see the pollster as just an anonymous nobody on the end of the phone, and some of these polls now actually use automated calling scripts, so-called robocalls, you'll press a touch tone literally. So there's no human interaction at all. So that might be another factor, is that people feel more free to express themselves.
I know you get an avalanche of mail. How much of it has to do with the Bradley effect?
I'd say like 20% of my incoming mail is about the Bradley effect. It totally fascinates people. One interesting phenomenon is if you ask people, would you vote for an African-American candidate for president, about 93, 94% say yes, if he were well-qualified. When they ask, would your neighbor do the same, only 70% say yes, I think my neighbor would. So people, I think, in some ways, assume the worst about other people or assume they maybe are more racist than they really are. But I think people in some ways are skeptical about, can this really happen? It is a lot of change, you know, quote unquote, to have an African-American be elected. I think people are having trouble maybe accepting it, you know, both people that want to see it happen and people that don't.
Nate, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Nate Silver is the founder of the blog 538.com.
The presidential newspaper endorsements are beginning to come in, and with them, some surprises. The Chicago Tribune, a paper that has never before in its 161-year history endorsed the Democratic Party's nominee for president, unbound its elephant hide and endorsed Barack Obama. The LA Times, after 36 years of not endorsing anyone, also came out for Obama. And in this nexus of media and politics, the big question is, so what? How much does a newspaper endorsement really matter? Greg Mitchell is editor of Editor and Publisher magazine, and he says quite a bit, actually.
I take issue with those who really kind of scoff at these endorsements because, especially as we've seen in the recent presidential races, where there have been so many toss-up states, battleground states that were decided by, you know, a relative handful of votes. Certainly an editorial endorsement in the mix of other things can, and I believe does have an effect.
Now, we're speaking on Wednesday. What's the endorsement count right now?
Well, Editor and Publisher has a long history of tabulating the endorsements. And for this year, as of now, our daily update has 126 for Obama and 46 for McCain. So it's quite a stark difference.
Now this year, the polls suggest that McCain is going to get swamped by Obama, and the endorsements are along the same track. In 2004, it was a very different environment.
Well, it was quite different in 2004, in stark contrast to this year. Our count of our tabulation then was that Kerry and Bush were splitting down the middle, the 420 endorsements. In the closing days of that campaign, I looked at the 15 toss-up states and based strictly on newspaper endorsements, both the number and the size of the papers in each of the 15 states, I predicted which candidate would carry those states. And when the votes were counted, I got 14 out of 15 correct and only missed on Florida. So, you know, that's anecdotal evidence, I suppose. But there were some states that were, incredibly tight, including Ohio and states like that. And yet, based strictly on the newspaper endorsements, I was able to get 14 out of 15 correct.
All right. So let's assume for a moment that that constitutes a legitimate methodology. If the election were held today, based on the endorsements you've gathered so far from the swing states in this election, how would the results go?
Again, as of today, 27 papers that endorsed George Bush in 2004 have swung over to Obama, and only four that endorsed John Kerry have switched to McCain. That's pretty startling. Another measurement that I'll mention is just today we did a tabulation of strictly the daily papers in red states. These are strictly the states that went for Bush in 2004. And we found by this count that 48 had gone for Obama and 28 for McCain. If I was the Republicans, and I know some people may disagree with this, I would be very concerned about that as an indication of how things are going.
Let me ask you one last thing, Greg. Obviously, the McCain-Palin campaign has to deal with the economy. It has to deal with the record of the Bush administration. But its opening salvo from the Republican convention on was to run against the media, to castigate the press. Is there any chance that the editorial boards are responding not only to the kind of underlying political circumstances, but to these attacks?
I don't think so, frankly. I think particularly when you look at the number of red state and GOP-leaning papers that have come out against McCain, I think, contrary to what many people have said, if you read these editorials, what stands out the most is the, I'd say, almost disgust that many of these papers, including the Republican papers, express about the pick of Sarah Palin. You read these quotes in these editorials. It's startling how many say flatly that she was unqualified, that the pick showed that McCain lacks judgment and so forth. And these are from papers that, indicated previously, endorsed George Bush just 4 years ago.
Greg, as always, thank you so much.
Happy to be here.
Greg Mitchell is editor of Editor and Publisher magazine. John McCain may have been stung by Colin Powell and the Chicago Tribune last week, but he did get one unexpected nod of approval from Al-Qaeda. A radical Islamic website put up a post that concluded a McCain-Palin administration would be in the best interests of global jihad. The McCain campaign described the proclamation as reverse psychology, a bid to move voters in the opposite direction. Joining us now is Melissa Joyner-Sykes, Associate Director for Central Asia Policy Analysis Coordination at the IAWGCM, the Institute for Asymmetrical Warfare and Global Confrontation Metrics in Beltsville, Maryland. Melissa, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
Let's start with the obvious. Why would Al-Qaeda be endorsing a candidate in the U.S. presidential election?
Well, Bob, first, it's not an endorsement per se. It's more like political analysis, a statement of what would most benefit global Muslim hegemony. But beyond that, it's been said this is the most important presidential election of our lifetimes. If that's true for Democrats and Republicans, it's no less true for Islamofascists.
Why?
Amid economic crisis, terrorists have families, too. The cost of inculcating their children with twisted philosophies of hate is going up, not down. The cost of explosives is going up, not down. Food, website hosting, infidel extermination videos. Where does the money come from? Remember, a terror cell, before it conducts its operations, is a small business. And Obama's tax policies are a big worry.
But Al-Qaeda is not naive. Could it, in fact, be employing reverse psychology intended to trick Americans into voting for a weaker leader?
Possibly. But it could also be reverse psychology or reverse psychology. Like that scene with Wallace Shawn in Princess Bride.
Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemies? Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I'm not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
Okay, for the sake of argument, let's just say that this exercise is somehow an endorsement of John McCain. Who's the target for the message? Red states? Blue states?
Mainly New Mexico, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, Arkansas, and Pennsylvania. In this case, it's the cave states, Bob.
Melissa, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Melissa Joyner-Sykes, who does not exist, is Associate Director for Central Asia Policy Analysis Coordination at the IAWGCM, the Institute for Asymmetrical Warfare and Global Confrontation Metrics, which also does not exist. The website story, though, is absolutely true.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Election night. It's the top of a new hour, just past 8 o'clock in the East, an hour of power for Bill Clinton. It could be the hour of decision. Bill Clinton wins the Keystone State, Pennsylvania.
In 1994, directors Chris Hegedus and D.A. Pennebaker released their documentary of the 1992 Clinton campaign, The War Room, with the tagline, "They changed the way campaigns are won." The they were George Stephanopoulos and James Carville, the strategists who managed Clinton's presidential bid. The change was their decision to put campaigning on a wartime footing, meeting incoming hits against their candidate with rapid-fire counterattacks. The War Room is brilliant, but it's not the film the filmmakers intended to make.
We really wanted to make a film about a man becoming president.
Director Chris Hegedus says they didn't get the access they asked for.
And, you know, although we have glimpses of Bill Clinton, he's not our main character. It's really a buddy story about James and George and their whole adventure of a lifetime, really, electing a president.
The War Room set the template for campaigning, not just here, but around the world, a film to which would-be Stephanopoli could always return for inspiration. But the directors only just returned to it after reacquiring the rights. They planned to make a quick look back as a special feature for the DVD and set out to reunite the old gang. They found that many were still in constant contact with each other and full of fresh insight. That's how they came to make Return of the War Room, airing this month on the Sundance Channel. Director D.A. Pennebaker.
Little by little, as we began to descend into the mire, it became clear that we weren't going to get away with an easy gig. We cursed this after a while, but the fact is that in retrospect, we found out many things that we didn't know and hadn't put in the original War Room.
Among many of the things I didn't know until I saw Return to the War Room was that Hillary Clinton had given it its name.
Yeah, Hillary was responsible for the name The War Room. James went to her and said that he wanted to set up a strategy central so that all the information could kind of go through one central place and their message could be unified. And she said, okay, that sounds like a great idea, but number one, you have to do it in Little Rock, and number two, you should call it The War Room.
But she went even further and said, we have to have a strategy. We can't let what we do be determined by the news media, by opponents, you know, like a billiard ball gone berserk on a table. We have to have a strategy. We have to hatch it. And James is going to be the one to do that.
There's a star in the Return film who doesn't make any but the most fleeting appearances in the first film, and that's Mary Madeline.
Yes.
We learn about the difficult and strained love affair she was having with James Carville at the time.
I think it was with Joe Klein, and she and I were having dinner in Washington, and I blurted out that I was going to be going to work for Bill Clinton.
I really thought I was going to throw up. It was somewhere in D.C. I just couldn't. It was a slap across the face. It was painful on so many different levels, and I ran into the bathroom, and
She went in the bathroom, and you'd have to ask her, but she was not very pleased.
I may have retched.
She also does double duty as a political commentator on the impact of the Clinton campaign strategy on the Bush campaign, where she was highly placed.
She stole the film. There's no question in our minds about it.
It was so candid, and she offered so many insights that I didn't know about in terms of Ross Perot and, you know, how serious a threat it really was for them, you know, as well as the problems of running the campaign of an incumbent.
An incumbency is encumbered by its inflexibility. The Clinton people were particularly good at what's come to be called rapid response, but it wasn't just that they responded rapidly. They thought fast. They could fix mistakes fast. They were really so good at what they did. But they were not burdened by the incumbency. If we wanted to do something, for instance, well, you'd have to go through the cabinet secretaries. And I remember cabinet secretaries, we can't do that. That's political. So, oh, my God, well, you're not going to be able to do it if we lose.
We have another character in our film from the Perot side of things, who is Frank Luntz, who, you know, really talks
a
lot.
What a surprising charmer in that film.
Isn't he marvelous? I love him.
He is the Republican strategist who came up with phrases like climate change to replace global warming and death tax to replace inheritance tax. This is a talent that he says he learned from that Clinton campaign.
All of these different words and phrases have been brought in. School vouchers became opportunity scholarships. And education choice became parental choice. It's all because of Clinton. And after he did it, I wanted to do it for those right of center to be at least as good as what he was doing for people left of center.
When I first laid eyes on him, he said something, and I thought, he's kind of like a boy genius, you know, and this is maybe very difficult. And it was a complete pleasure. Talking to him was such an interesting thing. I didn't want to leave.
We met him outside the Senate building, and he's sitting on a bench there, and lobbyists are just streaming by constantly, and he's calling out to them, you know, how'd your bill go?
Dennis Kucinich comes by in the film, and they're slapping each other's backs.
By the way, this guy here, I don't think we agree on anything political. He's one of my favorite people. And what's cool is, and this is the way it used to be, we had dinner a couple weeks ago. It used to be that you'd argue by day and get along by night. We're like the last people who get along. And it's really sad, but it's great seeing you.
So there's nostalgia there. I also felt a little bit of nostalgia for the technology that we saw in the original film, faxes, giant cell phones, and yet they were able to react so efficiently. You have several people in your film saying that it's a joke compared to what's available to them today.
It was all moving in today's terms at a dinosaur pace.
Everyone would gather to watch the evening news together because that became the headlines in the newspaper the next morning.
Literally, somebody had to like stay up at night and we had to get the newspapers, curry it in. There wasn't email. People would sit by the fax machine and wait for stuff to come in a copy. So it was a little, you know, a lot of things that we did then seem so antiquated now.
But I think they did a lot of novel things back in 92 for the technology they had. The Bush campaign, you know, were really slower and behind the times in a lot of things, to the point of, I remember when Clinton finally, you know, won and they went into the White House, one of the funniest things was that they only had typewriters in the White House, and the campaign couldn't believe it. There were no plugs around that they could put their computers.
After your film, War Rooms popped up in campaigns of aspiring politicians
all around the world. The War Room itself generated tremendous interest to the point where, I mean, you have in the film Stan Greenberg, the pollster, saying that he was hired by Tony Blair, and Blair not only wanted to know the philosophy behind the War Room, but he wanted to physically see the layout, the blueprints of the War Room. They tacked them on the wall.
Do you think that in the current political environment, when candidates never speak off the record to reporters anymore, when any random remark can be captured on a cell phone and sent around the world on YouTube, that any campaign today would let you in to wander around their back rooms?
Well, you're tempted to say no because it just seems hard. But I think, you know, you can always find somebody to marry you.
Chris Hegedus and D.A. Pennebaker, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Brooke Gladstone. We have a great time here.
Pennebaker and Hegedus co-directed and edited 1993's The War Room. Return of the War Room is airing this month on the Sundance Channel, next showing October 27th.
And finally, I want to thank the members of my brilliant, aggressive, unconventional, but always winning campaign staff.
Leaders are hailing criticism that Barack Obama is a patrician snob as a breakthrough for African Americans. In an op-ed in the New York Times, historian Dr. Robert Woodson wrote, 20 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that the news would portray a black man as out of touch with the working class. Dr. King's dream is now a reality.
That's tape from the Onion News Network, which does for video what the Onion newspaper does for print, send-ups of current events and of the media themselves. It is a near dead-on approximation of actual news in cadence, tone, visuals, and, of course, adrenaline. Here, after all, is what a real newscast from CNN sounds like.
Getting the jump on Election Day doesn't mean skipping the lines. Once again, Florida voters are encountering problems at the polls right now.
Now, think about the average Hollywood rendering of a newscast, which never quite feels right. It's always too actory and often too stilted, even when reporting on a terrorist attack like this clip from Die Hard.
We've had an update on the terrorist takeover of the Nakatomi building. Sources say the terrorist leader Hans, maybe this man Hans Gruber, a member of the radical West German Volksfrei movement.
So what does the Onion know about how to create the illusion of authenticity in news that the rest of the creative world seems not to? Will Graham is executive producer and director of the Onion News Network, and Carol Kolb is head writer. They both join me now. Will, Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Nobody else seems to have noticed, but you have, that newscasters don't just say their scripts, they actually kind of shout them into the microphone.
Yeah, we think there's something about newscasters that they're just louder and faster than normal human beings. But also, I think one of the major differences maybe from movie versions of the news or other comedy news is that most of our news anchors and the people you see in segments are actually real news people. And actually, one of our anchors got hired by CNN recently, which we took as a big compliment. You know, she called us one day and was like, well, another opportunity has come up in the world of real news. But we were excited by that. Yeah. We think it's great, you know, that they see us as sort of a model.
Well, I can't believe that they stole her, and I forever will consider CNN our enemy.
Life imitates art. How will you be able to take seriously anything she says when she's delivering, you know, the news?
Well, we don't take it seriously to begin with.
There is a segment that I saw recently that I actually stood and gave you an ovation. It was kind of a takeoff of a Sports Center, ESPN sort of reporting. But it wasn't about baseball, football, or basketball. It was, of course, about Sepak Takraw, a genuine Southeast Asian professional sport.
Right now, news from the International Sepak Takraw League. Bad boy Nguyen T. Butch Tui is grabbing headlines once again.
Basically, it takes sort of the cadence that a sports reporter has, but none of the actual facts are anything that we recognize at all.
It's unbelievable, Michael. I mean, Tui touches Rattan on 85% of the Tigers' volleys, okay?
Right.
He's earned the attention. He's got a roll spike rate of 93, but he's asking for more.
93 is great. What does he want?
Now look, when you're in your 13.1 by 6.4, you've got to be thinking in terms of your regular. Yeah.
We did a lot of research to make sure that if there was a Sepak Takraw fan out there, this was something that they would like.
And we actually saw in the YouTube comments for the video, there were several Sepak Takraw players and other people who were like, finally, we're getting some recognition.
The Onion actually, you know, it does cover the stories that other people aren't covering for some reason.
Yeah, it sure does that, but it covers them in exactly the way the others would if they did. How hard was it to get them as fluent in the language of ESPN as they appear here?
Well, they both, you know, have some background in sports reporting or in news and that kind of thing, but it definitely took a lot of takes. I mean, one of the hardest things was just all of the terminology impossible to pronounce, but also that particularly kind of over-caffeinated, slightly scary-sounding ESPN tone.
Okay, now, as much as I bow before you for having finally provided me what I've always wanted, verisimilitude in news satire, I gotta say that every now and then I detect a false note that just doesn't sound quite right. Here's one.
Emily Anderson is just 8 years old, but she's already taking part in the political process, helping her favorite candidate, Barack Obama.
McCain is a liar, so buy my cookies. McCain.
Without any help from her parents, Emily has raised enough money from selling cookies and lemonade to buy airtime for this political attack ad against John McCain.
You can make a lie sound like the truth if you say it over and over and over again. The key is to control the public dialogue.
The little kid actor sounded like, you know, a not terribly accomplished little kid actor, and it sounded false in exactly the way the bad movie news excerpts sound false.
First of all, I did not come here to be attacked, okay? but that's an area that is very hard, children.
But, you know, I actually think that little girl's pretty good, but there are definitely times where it's like you just show up and you're wrestling with someone and you don't get it all the way there. But, you know, we're always shooting for that total realism and authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
On the subject of near self-parody, there's an entire genre, the morning show, and I wonder if you've taken a pass at that one.
Yeah, we have a show called Today Now, and it's hosted by these two horribly chirpy people.
All right, well, while I'm getting this spray cheese up off the floor, Tracy's going to be talking to two special young men who are really making a difference in their community.
Thanks, Jim.
I don't know if you've seen the show Fox and Friends on Fox News. At first you're watching, and they kind of seem like really nice, friendly, personable, and then you kind of keep watching, and you're like, oh, these people are kind of evil. So that was sort of the takeoff of the tone for us.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell me everything about your project.
Well, in order to get our Eagle Scout badge, we needed to do a community service project. And we talked it over, and we thought that we'd do help women do their breast exams.
So how's your program going to work? I mean, where do you plan to do these exams?
Well, I think we're probably going to do them in my basement.
Now, I got to tell you, these kids, I got no complaints with their performance. They are perfection itself. But can you sustain the joke? I mean, how long can the Onion News Network continue to be funny just because it's such a dead-on parody?
We always like turn on CNN or Fox or one of the other channels and we see something new and we're like, oh, wow, do you see how that photo is in that box that's turning that way? Like, we got to do that.
I think as long as they keep going, we'll have plenty of stuff to do.
Well, you're doing God's work. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having us.
Will Graham is the executive producer and Carol Kolb, the head writer of the Onion News Network.
Spectators at the Breeders' Cup World Championships this weekend will see the first ever openly gay horse to run in a major stakes race. Jean Ann Wharton takes us beyond the facts.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh, Bill Bowen, and John Delore. We also had help from Michael Bernstein. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an information session for their new program, Master of Fine Arts in Interaction Design, on November 1st at the New York campus. More at interactiondesign.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.